Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And today's icebreaker question is something I borrowed from the sysadmin section of Reddit. How many of you completely unplug when you leave the office or leave your home or shut your computer?
Hi, this is Killian. I thought that was a really interesting and relevant question. And this is something I've struggled with for all of my professional career to date. It actually requires a lot more discipline than you think to be able to shut down at the end of the day. We're so often expected to be always on and always available. As a society, we expect all of our services to be like that, you know, our on-demand movies, our Netflix, everything like that. And we kind of take it for granted that, you know, our IT and our security staff are in the same position. So I've had to take kind of very deliberate steps in my life to disentangle myself, to get some work-life balance. And I'm doing air quotes because that's a favorite of people to say, and I'm not sure it's actually implemented all the time. I do carry a separate work phone, so at the end of the day, I'll leave it in my office, which I don't go in. I'd like to close the door and walk away at the end of the day to try and get some of that kind of mental separation. Now, I have a bad habit of coming back in and looking at it occasionally, but I won't respond to emails at night. It's just discipline, and it was very hard to get to this point.
All right, this is Mike Thompson, and I try to unplug to whatever degree I can, but I think it's getting harder over the years as, kind of like Killian said, more and more things are connected, especially when I worked for, you know, did more like help desk troubleshooting. If I came home and I had a, you know, my wireless router wasn't working, that was like a nightmare for me. The last thing I want to do is troubleshoot stuff at home. But even, you know, my you know, non-technical hobbies, things like making art, drawing, which I like to do, now a lot of times I do on an iPad. So even my so-called unplugged technology is now plugged back in.
Thanks, guys. So our housekeeping announcement is always, if you're a regular listener and enjoy your show, and if you don't like it, I'd also like to know, too, please go to iTunes to rate and review the Inside Out Security Show, and we'll put you in the running for a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. And to learn more, please visit veronis.com/review. And so let's go to today's show. When we had the WannaCry ransomware outbreak, no one could unplug. That was all over the news, but a few of our hardworking lawmakers, they were plugged into the root of the problem, and they introduced legislation called the Patch Act. And I initially thought that they were going to make everyone patch their software, and I was wondering how that was ever going to happen. But Patch stands for Protecting Our Ability to Counter Hacking. And so this means that they want to establish a Vulnerabilities Equities Review Board, which will determine whether, when, how, and to whom and to what degree a vulnerability held by the government might be disclosed to a non-government entity. And it's been debated where the challenge is finding the right balance between disclosing the vulnerability and national security. And based on your experiences, guys, what are the implications as well as the pros and cons?
I think the quote that really kind of jumped out to me from this article was Jeremiah Grossman from SentinelOne said, "The fact of the matter is the NSA isn't in the business of helping Microsoft protect its software or anyone else's software for that matter." This act is great. In theory, the government, if there's any, you know, known exploits that they can divulge that help increase our security, they should do it. They might balance economic security differently than, like, you know, national defense. You know, obviously we have different priorities as citizens than they do as a government. And I'm just curious to know if, even if this passed, you know, are we really going to see that disclosure? I don't know if it's in their interest to do that.
And as Mike mentioned, that's not the mission of the NSA. The NSA is supposed to gather the intelligence against the people that we want intelligence against. And it becomes a very interesting balancing act when offense outweighs good defense. Because if they find a security vulnerability that nobody else knows about, obviously nobody else knows about it. So all of their systems, all of the other DoD systems, the government systems, and everybody else is vulnerable to that. I don't think it's just economic damage. There's a lot of risk that they're taking on, even as an organization, by maintaining these and not disclosing them, that they can be risked. And, you know, there's a lot of smart people in the world. You know, I'd like to think that our guys are the smartest, but, you know, you can never underestimate our adversaries. So if we found a vulnerability, there's a pretty good chance that they might find it too. And then it's a matter of who's going to strike first. Is it worth it to have that offensive capability, or is it smarter to make sure that we're protected against the attacks. We have to assume that the other guy's going to come after us too. It's a very interesting balancing act, just from a security perspective. And again, the economic damages can't be underestimated either. If it's going to cost companies millions of dollars and affect our economy, there's going to be other calls to action.
I wondered if the Patch Act, if that gets passed, if it'll interfere with the potential business dealings of the hacking group Shadow Brokers. And we won't know yet. They released a statement that they'll be offering a subscription-based model like the Wine of the Month Club, where paying members will get a data dump every month, and then maybe afterwards they'll drink their wines.
This is almost like the old, mafia protection money type of thing. It's like, oh, you know, that's a real nice server farm you got there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. I think some people underestimated the Shadow Brokers earlier on. They had initially put up for sale all of these undisclosed zero days, and nobody ended up buying them. So they dumped them on the internet. And that's kind of where the situation is we found now. But they claim to have other ones and other information. It's a classic exploitation racket. Like, do you pay the quote-unquote protection money to get the information first from them so they win, they get their money one way or another? Or do you sit on it, call their bluff, and hope they don't dump more attack tools or more vulnerabilities to the world? And then, you know, the businesses who didn't pay up, in a sense, are forced to suffer the consequences. I mean, a protection racket's not a bad path if you lack of morals, I guess, to pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've kind of proven their value to an extent. I mean, this obviously, WannaCry has been such a global story. I don't think anyone's doubting the validity of Shadow Broker's claims, or at least not much as they were. So it's an interesting plan. You know, these subscription services are all the rage in general in pop culture and mass society. So why not do it in this kind of shady dark web hacking circle as well? I don't know. I mean, you brought up a good point. Is that Patch Act going to, you know, ultimately affect us in any way? You know, I was saying it's not in anyone's interest, and not in security agencies' interest to disclose this information. But if everyone's on a more level playing field, if these vulnerabilities are patched up across the board, you know, maybe that is the best approach. I don't know. But it's scary to think that, you know, these exploits could just go out to whoever the highest bidder is. But I guess I'd rather it go out to a lot of people via the subscription service than, you know, one foreign government that was willing to pay the million bitcoins to get the whole package. So maybe this is the best outcome we could hope for in terms of this hacking.
I also thought that they were trying to incite anti-American type government things, because they said, well, they should have patched it while they had a chance. And they're making money off of it, too. They're sort of justifying their actions. So with the two items that we discussed, it grounds us with a broader discussion that a lot of tech people brought back. There was a writer, Cory Doctorow. He gave a really popular keynote a couple years back called The Coming War on General Purpose Computing. And the premise is that computers are everywhere. They're sometimes in our bodies. They're running our vehicles, our planes and companies. IoT devices are basically everywhere and integrated with every aspect of our lives. And so the important thing is they must be trustworthy computers. But oftentimes we end up with computers that ship with malware, or we end up with programs that might override you, where you just can't make it do what it wants you to do, even if you're super tech savvy. So who should decide who can override who? And I'm also wondering if this is all or nothing thinking. It sounds like a doom or die thing. What are your opinions on his keynote?
I think kind of the main point he's communicating here is that a computer by nature is not limited in its abilities. Like the software, the manufacturers, different people have various reasons for imposing restrictions, but that's all limiting the capabilities of a computer. You know, an iPhone has all the computing power of a typical PC workstation to an extent, but it's locked down by the software to force only certain signed applications to run and all of this. So I think really what he's saying is that we keep implementing these new fixes, right? We're trying to make things more secure, more locked down. There's these kind of walled garden ecosystems like iOS, or like Microsoft just announced, I think it's Windows 10S that is similar. You actually have to pay money if you want to run stuff that's applications that don't come from their own application store. So we're kind of finding all these ways to control how users interact with the technology. However, you know, exploits still happen. This WannaCry exploit that came from the NSA, it doesn't matter. You can these exploits can attack an open system. They can attack a closed system, or rather affect a closed system. So there's always going to be challenges. There's always going to be a way to circumvent these restrictions. So with every layer of extra security, there's just new problems that arise.
I think that kind of speaks to the heart of what we talk about a lot is defense in depth. We can't rely on one security control to protect us. We can't rely on the operating system to be foolproof. As the systems get more complex, just by that very nature, it introduces more potential vulnerabilities. So we need to layer on these different controls. Having that, you know, walled garden approach certainly helps in one aspect, but that doesn't mean you can forego other avenues of protection or even just user training to know, you know, what looks safe, what looks suspicious, not to click on things that don't come from trusted sources, or heck, maybe don't even click on things that do come from trusted sources.
There's a debate between some security people say users aren't the enemy. To expand on that is security people say that, you know, we're not considering user experience design and they're not making it intuitive for people to understand how to figure out how to use it. And so if the technology's not built for even the most tech savvy people, that it's because it's a design problem, not a user problem.
I'm a strong believer that UI design is absolutely critical. If you look at, you know, what technology takes off and it's adopted, I mean, the iPhone, like Mike brought up, is a perfect example. Nobody cares. I mean, nobody, but probably our listeners and us here care about the security underneath, but the users don't. It's a very streamlined, simple interface that anybody can pick up and kind of make use of. And they've done a pretty good job of simplifying a lot of the security so the users can understand it, making kind of very, you know, turn on and off the certain services, or, you know, making what's a very complex task easy for the users so they're more apt to buy into the ecosystem and maybe be a little bit more secure. And I know Google does some of this too, where I think once a year they'll send out a thing like, hey, do a little security checkup on your, you know, your profile. So the easier you make security and the more friendly and approachable the interface is, the less people have an inherent fear of it. And I don't think users are the enemy. I think the bad guys are sophisticated, and I think people tend to want to trust other people. It's not a character flaw. I mean, that's the way we should be, I guess, in an ideal world. But there's a certain amount of cynicism I think that everybody needs to have, especially when working with technology, because there are bad guys out there, and it's so much easier for them to come in contact with us because we're out in the world.
Talking about this kind of made me think of, not to get too out of our realm politically, but the gun control debate. And, you know, here in America, you hear people say stuff like, oh, the only way to stop bad guys with guns is good guys with guns. In other countries, you know, they just really limit the access to guns. It's almost a non-existent problem. Obviously, we can't go that route, really. We can't just ban computers. I mean, we could go back to work the land, but that's not going to happen. So, you know, there needs to be an approach that makes sense and that really considers all of the issues that are presented with technology. And the analogy that came up in this Cory Doctorow piece was really the issue of people passing laws regarding technology, not necessarily understanding it in depth. And they don't necessarily need to. It's not their job to be technical experts, but they need to understand the issues in a way that allows them to pass good legislation. And he kind of makes the analogy of a car. You know, if bank robbers use cars as their getaway vehicles, you know, the solution is not to outlaw the wheel, because, you know, cars use wheels and that's how the people are moving. You know, it's not that outlaw cars. You know, that type of legislation is not going to pass. So we can't legislate out foundational pieces of technology that service so many other things, so many people, so many different other applications. So there might be more specific ways to approach it, but we can't change the fundamentals of what computers are and what networking is, just to have this essentially probably a false sense of security, because there's always going to be exploits.
That actually brings up an interesting point too. We do have some history actually with trying to legislate things that we might not completely understand. And again, I don't want to get too controversial with it. But if you look back at like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, passed, I think that was under Clinton in the 90s, mid 90s. Some of the fallout from that we're maybe even seeing right now, where, you know, the intent of it was to prevent people from pirating software and some other things. But the way it was written, it could be misapplied or applied very draconianly, where security researchers get sued from time to time for, you know, violating the provision of like bypassing security controls. So it's something that was, you know, broadly written and people have a way to broadly enforce, which has a detriment to security and society as a whole. Instead of taking some of these, you know, vulnerabilities that are discovered seriously, that can upset companies because it hurts business. If somebody comes out and says your software is vulnerable, don't use it. Obviously, it's affecting, you know, their revenue stream. They don't like that. So the easiest thing to do is to turn around and sue the researcher. You know, that's pretty complex, and I don't want to nail anybody specifically for it, but it's a risk that we take by creating legislation and not kind of thinking through the ramifications.
Now that we've had our tech philosophy diet, let's bring our attention back to a potential hack that some have been saying that's supposed to be even bigger than WannaCry. It's called Eduquiz. I have no idea how to pronounce it. And what it is it's a cryptocurrency miner that installs itself on a computer and it uses your computer resources to mine cryptocurrency. I think it's interesting how both of these attacks that are highly anticipated, well, WannaCry already happened, but, you know, researchers say that this is the one that's going to do more damage. And it doesn't sound like you get alerts that, you know, your files have been encrypted. Please pay X amount of bitcoins. You know, it's just hanging out at my house and not paying any rent. And then I get stuck with a huge electric bill. What do you guys think about this new supposed super dangerous malware attack?
Sounds like a bad roommate. You should probably evict them.
How would you know if it doesn't exist? It's like a silent roommate.
So, Cindy, what you're saying, just to confirm for the record, that you have a ninja as a roommate that uses your electricity and doesn't pay rent. Well, you know, so this malware that sounds like you just slammed your head in the keyboard and came up with a name. I think there was a couple interesting things about it. Some of the research said that this actually kind of took off even before WannaCry started, and it actually could have potentially even prevented some of the spread of it because as it used the exploits, it kind of closed the door behind itself because it didn't want to be discovered. And that's the whole point of it. It's more of a traditional type of malware or intrusion than ransomware. Ransomware is very much the smash and grab. It needs you to know that it's there because that's how you pay up. So it's very loud and noisy. This is much more of the ninja variety where it'll install and it'll use up CPU cycles to try and mine a cryptocurrency. So while it doesn't do upfront damage like a ransomware would, on the back end, it's ended up costing money and resources because it's using up computer processing cycles that could be used for legitimate business tasks to do the mathematical calculations to mine this cryptocurrency. And because the calculations to do the mining are very intensive, you know, the net result is that it requires more power to run the equipment and ultimately costs you a lot of money in electricity, which is kind of an odd thing. I bet there is a whole industry that, you know, takes that into account, the electricity and air conditioning, things like that for data centers, because it's massive, but this affects that portion of the budget, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, mining is very resource intensive, and that's why I think this is really kind of a brilliant use of a botnet. I mean, I feel like when we talk about botnets, a lot of times recently on this podcast, it's been distributed denial of service attacks and things like that, which, while interesting, you know, it's not making money. It's more of wreaking havoc. But this is saying, all right, I don't want to spend the resources. I don't want to spend thousands of dollars building this powerful computer that I'm going to use to mine currency. I'm just going to use this very easily exploitable bug that's out there and make everyone else do the hard work for me. So it's really kind of genius. It's scary that it can sit there silently and hijack your system and, you know, mooch off you. But as far as a practical use of a botnet, it's clever.
Do you prefer getting an attack where they alert you or a silent schmoozer like a bad guy ninja staying at your house that you don't know is there?
Well, we talk about this a lot with ransomware. It's one of the few attacks where it's in their interest to alert you. No one else wants to raise the alarm. Hey, I'm here. I've hijacked your system. So they're kind of unique in that sense. I guess I'd rather know. And I can, especially if it's my personal machine, like I could lose some photos or something. Hopefully I haven't backed up. But certainly if, I don't know. That's a good question, Cindy. I feel like it depends on what system's infected ultimately.
I think that's actually a great question, Cindy. It depends, I guess, well, on personality type, if we're talking about individually. Like, are you the type of person that, you know, if you have to take the medicine, you just do it and, you know, shoot it down and that's it? Or, you know, do you mix it in with some honey or something to try and coat it? As an organization, as a business, the calculation is much more on the loss of revenue. Between these two, between the two ransomware, or the ransomware WannaCry and the Bitcoin miner, my guess is that organizations would probably take the Bitcoin miner over the ransomware, because you figure with the amount of downtime it causes, you know, the upfront damage, some of the brand and reputation damage, you know, because you kind of, you know, you look at NHS in the UK, they had to come out and say that, wait a minute, all these hospitals went down, we've been affected. So that does a lot of brand damage to them. The cryptocurrency miner, it does cost money over time, but it doesn't necessarily as directly impact business. And it's something much more easily dealt with quietly. So I think as a business, I think they would probably prefer that one. Although the detection might take longer, it's doing one thing. It's not stealing information or doing anything directly malicious to the business itself. So they're not losing money in that aspect. They're losing money in ancillary costs like, you know, heating, cooling, electricity.
Good luck to the tech people having to explain this to the board. Okay, thanks to Killian Engler, Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can find some of the stories we're discussing. You can find us at @infosec_podcast. And thanks. We'll meet up again next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Cindy.
Bye.